Welcome to the Lou Cutino Show, where we can learn to reimagine our lifestyle.
Welcome to Reimagine Your Lifestyle. On today's particular show, you know, we're all interested in cardiology. We keep having questions about heart health, cardiology, why people suddenly drop dead. And today we have Dr. Sudhir Pillai, and he's a cardiologist with a story of his own and a massive amount of experience. You're on the show to help us with heart health, prevention, and safe recovery. Dr. Sudhir, welcome to our show, Reimagine Your Lifestyle. It's a pleasure to have you.
Nice, thanks for having me here.
What a firm, strong hand grip.
I've been told recently, but I guess I should soften it.
No, I think it's great. There's this whole study and research that talks about grip strength and longevity today. And it fascinates me. So I think that's amazing. But thank you for being here on the show. I know how busy you are. And this is Reimagine Your Lifestyle. We just want to teach people from experts like you, experience, science, knowledge, everything that you see every day, how to live better health. You know, better lives. You know, a lot of people go through cardiac problems, currently have been diagnosed with cardiac problems. How do they live over and beyond just medicine? You have an amazing story of your journey when you were studying cardiology. So I would love for you to start off with that and also just take us through your life from then till now. And did you always want to be in this field of medicine?
Well, I never wanted to be in medicine to start. My schooling was in an army school.
Okay.
And all I wanted to do was to join army. So I qualified through the NDA, but my mother refused. No army. So I sneaked out and she said, you have to do medicine. This is mid-80s. One, my brother got engineering, so I said, the second one has to do medicine. Mm-hmm. So I had no choice. So I said, still medicine? All right. So I appeared for Armed Forces Medical College and I got in there. But my mother stopped that and she said no, because that time the IPKF was in Lanka and three doctors of Indian Peacekeeping Force had died because of LTTE.
Oh.
And she somehow read it. I mean, my unfortunate thing that she read it and she said, no, you're not going to AFMC. And fortunately, by the time GS Medical College admission came up, so I got into medicine that way. So it was reasonably smooth sailing because GS Medical is a very academic place. Now, how I got into cardiology was one more aspect, because my father suffered a heart attack at the age of 47. He was young, but he was a diabetic, and then a few of his relatives also had heart issue, and I somehow it was in deep, somewhere like a trauma in my mind that if I do something in medicine, I should try and become a cardiologist.
Mm.
But you have to slog a lot to be a cardiologist, because in those days it was one of the most premium branches. It still is, I hope so. So, did my MBBS, then I did my MD in Grand Medical College, then got into cardiology in Grand Medical College. I finished cardiology in 2001, worked in Madras Medical Mission Hospital in Chennai for 3 years, and then I went to Australia for a fellowship in intervention cardiology, came back 2008, I joined Kokilaben Hospital in Andheri, and then 2011, I joined Hinduja Hospital, which I'm still attached to, and that's what my academic is. Other than that, yes, it's been a difficult but very successful, I can say, academic career so far.
Mm-hmm. I'd love for you to tell me the story that we were talking about right before, when you had the problem with your back and you were told that you may not be able to practice, and how you changed your life.
I suppose it started from there. I was too young to get it, but I had all the reasons to get it. See, it was kind of very sedentary life. You study and you do nothing. There was no awareness. Being still in cardiology, there was no awareness that exercise is important. You advise, but even I was 25, 20, 26 or 27 maybe. Had a massive disc prolapse. I was told that you may need a surgery, but I was bedridden for a month, but it hit my mind. Because then you're told to leave cardiology and probably do something else. But then you also, as a youngster, you don't want something incapacitating with you. That's fine, right? That you can't run, you can't exercise, you should not do this. I said, I have a long life ahead. I can't do all this. So once I recovered, it was still stayed in my mind. That's the time I realized how trauma sets in your mind and it could create problems. I would get fictitious backache also. I used to get pain in the back without anything. Any small stress factor, I would catch my back. Oh my God, my back is going away. Well, it's going to give away. So that's the time I had to do something. I said, either live in that vicious cycle, loop of disease, or get out of it. So did, which I don't know, it's against medical advice, but I thought it's something I need to do. So gently started running. So first day, I suppose it probably half a kilometer also was enough to kick me, strained and tired, but gradually it built on. Chennai was the place I started running, and then Australia was a magnificent place to run. I came back, Bombay, yes, I continued with my run at the race course. Then run overtakes your life. Then I got it completely into that runner zone where you decide your work depending upon how well your running schedule is fitting in. So when I was in Coquelabin, I used to run from 5 to 6 in the morning, get up 7:30, drive up, work there next day. Then half marathon came in. My friend from Delhi had come once. He said, I'm running half marathon. Why don't you join? So I gate crashed first data. It was Standard Chartered in 2006. Gate crashed that run. I had no bib, nothing. I just ran with him. And I could finish that, which I was quite surprised. And that's how it started. 2011 is the time I moved on to full marathon. So 2011 to 2016, I did most of the Standard Chartered and Tata full marathon. Some one I did in Chicago and one in Kuala Lumpur. 2018 is the time the thing is then I started running more for ego than for pleasure, because that's a very basic human nature, that you want to get better and you want to improve the numbers over dominate you. I forgot that I have a family history of heart disease. So 2018 is the time when I started getting some discomfort in the chest while running, which, you know, man lives in denial. 20 years of education, you preach every day to the patients, you know the problem deep inside, I know what it is, but you live in denial, that the myth, that's time I understood the myth that running will prevent heart disease, that running will overrun your genetics, running will overdrive it. You running will change your genetics that you can prevent a heart disease. That's the time when it happened, it crushed my whole understanding of cardiology. That it took me a while to accept it, that yes, I also suffer from it, for which I tried for 15 to 18 years to prevent it, but I still got it. But see, I underwent that surgery in 2018, very understanding what I'm getting. But I did it for two reasons. One is that I wanted to have a reasonably good life after that. And second is, you practically, what do you do otherwise?
Yeah.
So when you left with no choice, you pick the best possible option and make the most out of it. And that's how it has been. Never gave up after that. Even on the day of surgery, I just told my wife that two things will happen. I will come back, it'll give me 3 months. And I had already registered for New York full marathon that November, which of course I couldn't.
Yeah.
I said, Standard Chartered is coming. On the day of surgery, one day prior to surgery, I went to register in the evening, that I'm going to register it. Whatever happens, I will run it.
Wow.
So it is probably giving me only 5 months after surgery, but I will run it. And I don't know what happened. It's just the grace of God, or just luck, or maybe it's just the same. I said, the strength of your mind, which tells
purpose.
You, which guides you. Yes, it's a purpose. I could finish, and it was a huge thing for me.
Wow.
Because in one shot, I overcome all my fear. And I said, all right, things are fine. Now, here on, you have to learn from what you've gone through. See, for me, sorry for the monologue, but
no,
I understand trauma as inevitable. Everyone will go through it in some form. It's not a very pleasant thing to talk about, but it is inevitable in life. Whether I say it or it has been said. So if you just follow Buddhist law, it has been, it's there. When you go through trauma, there are three options. One is you give up and you probably go in self-pity and stay there all your life. Second is, you don't know what to do and you go on some umbrella. That's what we call it as philosophical suicide. You find some philosophy, ideology, and you try to find answers. And third is, you take the onus on yourself. That I have gone through it. It's my problem. I will deal with it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best word. So that's what I have healed myself. And I don't know what happens to the future, because I've stopped thinking about the future. And that's the second lesson I learned. That you don't live there.
Yeah.
Don't all their life from your childhood we have lived for exams, results, exams, results, exams, results. We never lived what is it going to happen today. Mm. Again, exams next year, exam next year, career next year, fellowship next year, career next patient. Discharge after 4 days. We're always there. We never going on what's happening here. Mm-hmm. So that was the essence, and that was my biggest learning. So somehow I feel I'm at peace.
Wow. You seem to have such a positive outlook, such a positive attitude. Is this something you developed along the way, or has it come with your practice of seeing patients, your own journey?
It has happened last 5 years. Mm-hmm. I tell people bypass was the best thing which happened to me in my life. They feel very awkward. And they feel very surprised. But it sometimes it's necessary. Mm-hmm. It's necessary to come to terms with your life. That we just assume that we are going to, nothing will happen to us. We are living forever. We'll do it later on. We push our problems to later on in life. I will do that later on. We don't understand the essence of time. We take our life and we take our happiness, everything for granted. Without realizing that, it's not in our control. It's not in our control. We don't have to push ourselves so hard to live in future. We accept it, reconcile to the world. So surgery has, I tell people that it's made me more human than part of a time machine.
It's beautiful.
So my relationship with a lot of people have improved. I've calmed down. I take time as only a limited factor in my life. I have a lot of time. Now people ask me, why do you have so much time? I said, I don't know. I have more discipline in my life. Yeah. I have learned some good aspects in life. I have discovered something which I never thought I was capable of, and that is art. Mm-hmm. So I spend a lot of time with my art. It's nothing. It's me communicating with the canvas. Yeah. And that's such a good biofeedback. It has been very healing.
Beautiful. Beautiful. So there is a huge emotional and mental element when it comes to people, whether they're looking at prevention, recovery, that has to be integrated into the human spectrum of living, right?
See, we are working at our conscious level. We don't know what all is behind that mask.
Yeah.
See, you or anyone, we have a mask.
Correct.
We have multiple masks. We just keep changing every day. Mm. I leave at home, I become a doctor, or maybe I'm a driver when I'm driving my car, but we keep shuffling those masks, right? Without knowing what all are going inside. And who communicates with that? It just remains there all your life and you probably die with it without even knowing what you are. Yeah. And these all become part of what I call it shadows, and that's what it's called, shadows. So first 30 years, you accumulate things as your shadows, as your bag, and probably next 30 years, you should relieve them one by one. And how do you relieve shadows? You can relieve shadows only through art, or you go to a counselor. So art happened accidentally to me, but it's such a huge experience to just pick up a canvas and draw something and saying that this is me. It takes an effort because some of them are really scary. Who's that person? I said, that's me.
Now, what's your take on humor and laughter? There's so much of science that's come out now. We believe in it. Our patients feel better. I mean, we know the whole neurotransmitter connection of when you laugh, your serotonin and dopamine, endorphins. And you seem to have that kind of a spirit. Do you believe in all of this? Like, you know, laughter and humor can actually help the human body cope better or actually deal with things?
I will not go and say that laughter should be artificial. Mm. I will not say that you go and join a laughter club and it will heal you. Yeah. No. I will probably laughter will come only after you move away from, say, your general worry in life. Mm. That this is worrying me, that is worrying. There's no end to it. There's no end to what things can worry you. So you will seek laughter, or you probably laughter will come out naturally, or your happiness or your smile will come naturally when you accept that, all right, there are problems in life, but there are good things in life too. Mm. Depends upon what you want to pick up.
Yeah.
So if your general intent is to pick up only negative things in life, you will never laugh.
Yeah.
So that becomes your personality, right? Mm-hmm.
True. So doctor, now with your experience over the years, you shared your beautiful experience with us, and experience over the years, you know, what's going wrong? Why is there so many more problems? I mean, we know the basic stuff, you know, there's lifestyle, there's this, but with your experience, you know, I mean, considering there's so much advancement today, be it in technology, medicine, nutrition, exercise, awareness, but yet there seems to be so much of, you know, cardiac problems and people living with issues, laundry lists of medicines as they age. What's going wrong? What's some of your insights on this?
So I may be a little bit an outlier here. I mean, it's easy to say that people are more stressed, people are more fat, people are more sedentary, people are eating bad things.
Yeah.
It's there. No doubt it's there. But what I see is that what is one thing which is missing? What nobody wants to talk about, nobody likes to talk about. And that's part of a lot of degenerative diseases or lifestyle disease, you call it, whether you call it diabetes or you call it cardiac issues or blockages or cancers or Alzheimer's. And that's the next big thing which is going to happen. My understanding is that the common denominator of all this is your insulin levels. If your insulin level remains persistently high, it is a degenerative thing.
Yeah.
It will create those factors. It will create those growth factors. Mm-hmm. And you go and read all the literature. Cardiac disease, insulin. Diabetes, insulin. Alzheimer, you dissect down. You say, no, drop your insulin down. Cancer, you drop your insulin down. And why is the insulin so high? The insulin high because of two reasons. One, what is the muscle mass? Where is the muscle mass? Where is the hidden fat? And number two is, how much carbohydrate intake?
Yeah.
So people have gone wrong about, say, about, I start with food. People have gone wrong from shifting from, say, a normal diet of fat plus protein plus carb, minimum carb, to zero fat or minimum fat to protein plus carb. And when it comes to protein plus carb in Indian scenario, where 60% of the population vegetarian, the carb protein disappears.
Yeah, the carb
and they become 80% carb. So that is one. Now, 1977, somebody in Senate in US says that, man, let's reduce the fat intake and cut off carb and let people eat non-fat. That prevent heart disease. But what happens? After that, you see there is a spike. Everyone's becoming obese.
Yeah.
So everyone's becoming diabetic. The insulin levels have gone up because the food is becoming predominantly carb. So that is one thing happened. Second thing is this trans fat, as we discussed, that it has... Probably it came as an obvious factor. I said, 1950s, they actually thought it's healthy. In 30s and 40s, they thought margarine is healthy.
That was the butter, actually.
It was healthy. They thought it was healthy. It said it will prevent heart disease. And to now it is hidden trans fat. So quality of food has changed. The quantity, of course, has gone up. So that insulin is has gone up. Second, where is the protein muscle mass? We have almost 50% of most malnourished or undernourished children in the world. We, as a developing or developed society, one third or probably 40% of protein calorie malnutrition are in India. And they are the first 5 years of their life. That decides your muscle mass. And by the time 20, 60% of girls are undernourished. And girls are undernourished, their infants are undernourished, and they are born with a disadvantage. People say, lean, I'm thin, I have no fat. If you do their body mass index under DEXA,
The muscle is less.
The muscle is fine, maybe there, but they will have 20 to 30% body fat. You do DEXA and their pelvic fat is hidden there. They say my body mass index is fine, doctor, I should not get in trouble. But I, for example, I give my example, though it's a personal data. My body mass index is 21. It's healthy by all standards. But what is my body fat? It's 26%. It's all there. It's because genetically, it's accumulating around my intestine or something. So that 26% is actually metabolically obese by US standards. So I am an obese man. I'm a fat man, though I may look lean, but that's where the problem is. So the issue is, if you ask me where the problem is coming from there. How do you deal with it? It's a lifestyle choice. And it's a very difficult choice because if you go across, ask any diabetologist, endocrinologist, most kids in the school, there is a huge amount of metabolic syndrome going on. They do their insulin levels, almost 50% will have high insulin. By the time they are 14, 15, the plaques, the smile blockages or deposits starts in mid second half of your life. When they dissected the autopsy of young Korean soldiers in US war in Korea, they found that almost most of them had cholesterol deposits. And they were young guys, 20s. So deposit starts there. And by the time we test ourselves at the age of 35, 40, we are there.
Mm.
And then the trauma starts. Then the issue starts. Whether what causes heart attack? For example, I'm a runner. I say that my run is going to prevent heart disease. No. Mm-hmm. If my lifestyle choice was not right at the age of 20s and 30s, I already have got, say, the seeds there, and no amount of running is going to reduce it. You have to accept that fact it's there, but you have to make sure that you adapt to it and make sure it doesn't build up. So problems, what we are not dealing with, we are advising middle age what to do, but we are not advising looking at colleges and looking at that. We have the youngest population in the world. We are not looking at there and say that, you know, this is the problem. Go to the gym. Exercise, increase your protein mass, but where does the protein come from? Till last year, I'm just going a little off mark. In schools, in midday school in Maharashtra, they were not supplying eggs. Why? Because the donors won't allow it. Why? Because the donors were vegetarians.
Mm.
That is not right, because the food choice should not come from donor. Food choice come from the consumer.
Correct.
They are young kids, they are malnourished. I ran a small program in Neral. Neral is it's about at the base of Matheran. There's a small school, about a village school. So me and my daughter, she was interested in that. We ran we adopted a small school where we did a screening test for about 80 kids. We were 30% undernourished. We did a weight, height, and then we started replacing 2 eggs per day per child from our expense. Mm. And it was not expensive. You know, one school would cost me, say, 8,000 a month.
Mm.
It's like going not eating out a day, a month.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
But that was sufficient for 80 kids to get 2 eggs a day. And we followed up with another data after about 8 months. And we said those 30% of kids who were undernourished with 2 eggs a day, we could pull out most of them out of that undernourished zone.
Wow.
We presented this data in American Society of Nutrition. My daughter presented it. And so that's all it took. And that's all it should take. And that's where it should start from. Not at looking at 40s and 50 where things are already there. People are dying or running marathon, but they don't realize that problem has started at 20. You cannot reverse it.
Wow. What is the testing that people can do when it comes to this, you know, the body mass index? Does everyone have to use these machines? Or because it's a good, I think what you were referring to is the whole skinny fat Indian, basically, where you may be skinny on the outside, but inside.
I call her skinny from behind, skinny from not from front.
Yeah, that too. So how can they check? Like, how can the general public start to check? What's the best test that you would recommend for them to check, you know,
check about their metabolism or check about
their body fat?
So best test remains as DEXA.
DEXA, yeah.
It's a part of most health health checkups, but nobody looks at the data.
Mm.
They'll do DEXA, they'll look at bone
density. Bones, exactly. Usually only
but
for that.
But on page 4,
yeah, it has your protein, it has your muscle.
It has your muscle percentage, it will have your fat percentage. It will show your distribution of fat. So that's what I think I suggest a lot of patients, those who come and ask me, young patients, why did I get it? I'm fine. I don't have any of the risk factors. Why do I say 20% I cannot explain.
Mm.
That's my limitation of science. But still we can pick up something that this is where you're metabolically going wrong. You do your liver scan, you find fatty liver. Grade 1 fatty liver is given in India.
Yeah.
Now everyone has got grade 1 fatty liver. Why should it be there? But
yeah, it's accepted like a norm today.
Why should we accept
it? People have that.
It's got normalized.
Yeah.
It's like fasting sugar of 120 has got normalized. Yeah. HbA1c of 6 is normalized. You can't be normalized like that for a youngster. Yeah. Normalized for, say, 70s, 80s, even that.
Thanks for sharing that. The insulin. So again, that comes down to carbohydrates, like you rightly mentioned, either too much, wrong quality, probably with a sedentary lifestyle as well. I love that you speak about insulin because there are very, very few people who relate it to everything else except diabetes, because people think insulin is only to do with diabetes and not inflammatory markers for metabolic health. So that's brilliant. So what are the other things? Do you notice a correlation between sleep deprivation and heart health?
There is no direct correlation that if you sleep less, you will get it.
Mm-hmm.
But sleep is important to, especially quality of sleep, not the duration of sleep.
Correct.
Mm-hmm. With how much is your REM sleep and how much your deep sleep you are getting. Because sleep is the best exercise we can have. That is a nature's gift to you, every animal, that you have to reset yourself and start afresh. Mm-hmm. No sleep means your hormones to fight, like norepinephrine, adrenaline, remain persistently high. When it has to go down at some point. And more those hormones remain high, more cortisol remain high.
Mm-hmm.
So this is all related.
Yeah.
Whether if you develop obstruction in your sleep and you've got obstructive sleep apnea, definitely it is going to correlate with not just your insulin, your kidney issues, your cardiac issues. It has got direct relationship.
Yeah.
So not just the duration of sleep, it's the quality of sleep which is mm-hmm. important. So 7 hours, ideal. 6 hours, all right. But not less than that,
yeah,
definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And especially if you are a runner, if you exercise, and if you have cognitive work through the day, then mm-hmm. you cannot not have a good night's sleep.
Right. Is it actually true that they're calling Alzheimer's a type 3 diabetes because of the impact, again, of insulin and inflammation on the brain, literally?
It may be.
There's so much of correlation. I mean, like, again, most Alzheimer's patients, when you look at the data, okay, insulin metabolic syndrome, like, there is the whole connection, you know, indirectly or directly. I don't know whether science will conclude with this.
It will be very difficult to conclude that because,
First
of all, unless we find that age of Alzheimer is setting in earlier, then probably we may blame mm-hmm. it. But the thing is, our population is also aging. So
we're seeing more numbers right now. We're able to catch it.
Course of neurodegenerative, but there is definitely a correlation. It's a lot of studies are coming between your baseline insulin levels, lack of sleep, obstructive sleep apnea versus delayed onset or early onset Alzheimer's mm-hmm. or any kind of neurocognitive dysfunction.
Mm-hmm. Doctor, all this happening where, you know, young people dropping dead in the gym or marathon runner, you know, runners falling dead, and there's this whole fear out there. You know, what's your take on this? I mean, there are so many things correlated with it. But then the question that keeps coming up is like, oh, but this person was working out. I know you've already answered it, that, you know, a runner, you know, just because you're a runner can't solve problems that are built up in your body. But what are some of the reasons that you've seen in the last couple of months and years that have caused these sudden attacks?
I feel those who do it for pleasure, they are fine.
Mm-hmm.
Those who are doing for ego, they are in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, you have to understand that what did Hippocrates say? He said it 2005 years back that moderate nutrition mm-hmm. and moderate exercise is the key to long life.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the important, moderate. Now, how do you judge moderate exercise? So exercise, if you call exercise a medicine,
mm-hmm.
now exercise is medicine, that means it follows the rules of medicine.
Mm-hmm.
That over-exercise is like drug abuse, overdrugged. So if you are exercising beyond a limit, it's going to harm you.
Mm-hmm.
So moderate exercise is what everyone has to understand. So if people are getting into trouble, it's because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Though there are outliers both ways. The people don't exercise and still healthy, and people who exercise also over-exercise get in trouble, and those who are fine. So there are outliers in both. So there is a drug response curve.
Mm-hmm.
As long as we are reasonably within the drug response curve, we are reasonably all right. The problems happen when we overdo ourselves, and problem happen, we add an acute load on our existing system.
Mm-hmm.
So if I lift 28 kilo of weight, and after 3-4 days, suddenly I go and do a 60
mm-hmm.
pounds weight lifting, I'm going to get in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
I may or may not, but I'm increasing the probability of getting in trouble.
Correct.
Same thing with running.
Mm-hmm.
If I've not prepared well, I've not run well, I've not conditioned myself well. See, if you understand, if you look at it, most of the deaths which happen during running. So let me stick to running. The switch happens between the age of 35. So young athletes who are dying, unfortunately data in the world is all about athletes. They have not data on, say, the demography of runners has changed, right?
Mm.
Now it is more of amateur runners than athletes. So you can't project athlete data on
amateurs.
So before the age of 35, most of the deaths happen are because of cardiomyopathies, genetic diseases, arrhythmias, the electrical issues of the heart. They're born with it, a congenital heart defects, undetected. Hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, extra muscles in the heart. But after the age of 35, 90% of heart, 80% are because of blockages in the heart circulation. Chances of sudden cardiac death in runners, the data is variable. It has varied from 1 in 40,000 to 1 in 1 lakh. That means if 1 lakh people are running,
mm-hmm.
one will get in trouble.
Mm.
So that is the data. So if, say, our marathon here in Bombay, if you have 20,000 running, if you collect 4-year data of 20,000, one death is going to happen. So that is what the data says. Now, Also, it says that most of the heart attacks happen where the blocks is less than 50%.
Less than 50%.
Okay. So, and 50% heart, if you have 40% block, you can run a full marathon, you can be an ultra runner, and it will not trouble you. But it can rupture and can become 100% in 10 seconds. And that is, if it's not your excessive physical stress, it is your bad luck. That cannot be prevented. It cannot, no runner can have 0% chance of dying. I'm sorry, it may be a little bit of alarming statement, but 0% is not possible. There's always a possibility.
Yeah.
20% of runners who died, have whose autopsy were done, they had normal heart. Normal heart, no blockages. We still don't know why. It's still an evolving thing. But in autopsies are to be taken with a pinch of salt, because even the best of the pathologists tell you that they are not very confident of what they are reading out in the autopsy. So we don't have genetic autopsy. We don't have molecular autopsy in this country and most places. So we don't know why those 20% deaths have happened. So it is never 0%. You can only try your best to bring the probability to as low as possible, for which proper training and proper evaluation. So if you are 35, you're a good runner, if you have a family history of heart disease, if you had a history of smoking in the past, if you diabetes is, you know, sugar is around HbA1c 5.8, 5.9, you may be a good runner, but get evaluated. I would still suggest those who are athletic between the age of 40 and 50 get one CT coronary done. There is no harm in getting one scan done. See, I equate it very simple thing. If you're going for a drive from here to say Ladakh, wouldn't you mind, would you
check your car?
Check your car? You open the bonnet and get service and check me. So if you are doing that for your car and if you are going to run 42 yourself, what is the harm in getting yourself checked whether I have blocks or not? At least you will know where you stand. So that I suppose important. Simple thing, forget about CT scan, even simple ECG, 100 rupees. When we have marathons, we upload Aadhaar card, we upload scores, we data.
What a good idea.
Why can't we upload one ECG? Why can't somebody sitting there screening those 20,000 ECGs? AI will screen it.
Yeah, that, in seconds.
That this is abnormal.
Wow, that's a brilliant idea.
He should
idea.
Not. Italy, 10 years back or maybe 15 years back, made it a rule. No athletic activity in Italy will happen unless there is an ECG. You can't go and run marathon there or half marathon there or go for a cross-country 200-kilometer cycle or 500-kilometer cycle without a proper ECG officially. When they applied that, they reduced the sudden cardiac death by guess how much? 90%.
Wow.
Wow. So one ECG worth 100 bucks prevented almost 90% death. So I think it should be made a rule.
Mandatory, yeah.
Everywhere, all official marathons or runs more than 21 kilo or 21 kilometers, that at least get one ECG uploaded. Yeah. What is there? Or show it to somebody and upload it. You need not be sitting here because it will add to the cost. But I suppose ECG is not a costly thing.
Yeah, I mean, that's your most preventive. People, yeah. Wow. So, yeah, so we can start off with that stress test, 2D echo, and of course, like you said, a CTO, a CT angio, if we're going to go in for something
why
really
strong. Stress test is, stress test is, the utility is not enough. It's not very
not
sensitive.
Enough. Okay. Or no, for a general population.
General population.
Who's not running? Just like a day-to-day person going to work and stuff.
It's enough.
Good enough.
It's good enough if you are asymptomatic and if you have no risk factors.
No risk factors.
But if you ask me if my stress test is normal, am I normal? I cannot.
Not necessary.
Not my say, let's say yes, no, you're normal. Why? No. Stress test works on pre-test probability. If your pre-test probability is low, stress test results are nice, you are fine. But if the pre-test probability is high, the stress test may not be the answer. Simple data. If you have, if you make 100 men with a 90% block in one artery, that's a serious disease. And make them run on a treadmill. Treadmill will pick up only 70% of them. 30% treadmill will come negative. Now, is data strong, is data comfortable enough? No. Even if you have three vessel blockages, treadmill stress test will pick up only 85%. It's a good 85%, but it'll pick up 85%. 50% will come become still false negative. So treadmill is to be applied along with other data. If you have family history of heart disease, if you are an athlete, then general whatever treadmill protocol we use for three stages boost protocol is not enough. You have to go beyond that. And most people places they don't do it.
So where does a 2D echo come in for this?
2D echo is of not much use in cardiovascular disease.
Mm.
It remains normal, even if you have got, say, 100% block in all three arteries. 2-day echo will start showing changes only if you have suffered a damage or you are close to one.
Mm.
2-day echo is good if you have valve issues, and if you've got muscle issues, the heart has dilated or hypertrophied or cardiomyopathy. Mm. So utility is not much. It's just an add-on screening thing. It's useful, but stress test is pegged higher.
So CT is definitely in today's...
CT is, yes, I know it's costly. I understand that it's not covered by most insurance as an outpatient thing. But if you ask me, one test to be done between the age of 40 to 50 to know where you are. Because I get patients who got lipid profile, say LDL of 150. I don't put statin or not. They have family history heart disease. Now, it's 130 LDL. But 130 LDL may be fine for him, but not for this gentleman who's got probably a different kind of pathway going on.
Correct.
So probably he needs an LDL of 70, but how to convince him?
Mm.
Sometimes I tell him to get a CT scan done. If you're already showing plaques developing, and you have 20% plaque already there. You may I'm not saying you will, you may reduce your probability of this plaque progressing by at least getting your LDL level to a reasonably decent value. And so that is where the role of CT scan comes. I think it should be part of, at least once.
Between 40 and
50. Because that's where the crux, the main important life, that's where you are going to be at the peak of your career, right? And you don't want setbacks.
What's your take, doctor, then on this whole concept? There's so much of conflict around total cholesterol versus your ratio of your triglycerides and HDL, where if your ratio of triglycerides and HDL is excellent, your LDL is found to be higher in certain people who are active, and it's completely not taken as a cholesterol issue. You know, again, stress test was done, 2D echo and all of that stuff. These are becoming norms where people are saying you don't have to be medicated on a total cholesterol if your ratios of tris and even if the LDL is on the higher side. What's your take? Because there's so much of mixed information around
there
this.
There is a lot of information. It's all confusing. But I look at only a few factors. One is, if the LDL is to be taken along with other data. Look at your triglyceride, your family history, your diabetes, your atherosclerotic, or you already had a disease, or your CT coronary, so it's something. Even if your LDL is 110, which is normal, but if you are developing blocks in your heart circulation, I will not accept LDL.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'll bring it down to 50, 60.
Absolutely, yeah.
But if your LDL is, say, 135, 140, which is a gray zone, but if you are clean and say no family history, nothing, then I'll probably hold it back. But to expect that diet will change the LDL is a myth.
Yeah.
It will not happen. Triglyceride, yes, we can work on it. But again, which LDL? Most labs, 99% of the labs will not give you small LDL value. So there are two types of LDL. Small dense LDL and normal LDL. Now, no lab measures small dense LDL. So if your LDL is, say, 120 and the small LDL fraction is 60% of it, it's a very unhealthy LDL, because this small LDL fraction is the what? Which causes atheroma blockage. Nobody measures it. You have to lab this to do it separately. The only one lab or two labs which are doing it here, or even my hospital doesn't do it, unless you specifically request for it. So if you want to do a lipid profile, if you bank on LDL, then you need to know your small, dense LDL fraction. You need to know your LPA. Now, lipoprotein A is hardly measured. It is 6 times more atherogenic than LDL. And LPA is genetic. It has to be taken into account. So if your LDL level is high and LPA level is high, I have to treat your LDL, because I have nothing to treat your LPA. Other than try to manipulate diet and see whether I can fall. I have some patients who LPA has fallen with diet. I don't know how, but it has fallen.
And the lipo, if that is decent and the LDL is still slightly on the higher side, you're okay with that?
I'm all right with that. I don't chase LDL too much if there are, it is not creating. Otherwise, you end up giving statin to so many people.
Yeah, exactly. Because most people will fall in the category of a statin.
I'd probably make them run and get them to some intermittent fasting and get them triglyceride to 65 and bring them SDL and live with it.
Nice. You believe in fasting as well, doctor?
Of course. Well, how will you control your insulin?
Exactly. The only way is to keep gaps between meals.
Right. It should be made mandatory.
Yeah.
Sorry.
No, but you're right. Because this can solve so many problems. And it's part of our culture. It's part of every religion, spiritual part to fast, right? I think there's just too much of food available and so easily available.
That's what, there was more because we, you know, there's something called as, two examples, there's something called a thrifty gene hypothesis. Now, thrifty gene hypothesis is what they try to explain why South Asia is getting so many cardiac issues, metabolic issues, why Indians who go to West do worse. not Indians, South Asians. So they, the important thing they said that this subcontinent has gone with so many phases of undernutrition, starvation, that we are genetically tuned to live with very low storage. Mm-hmm. We never stored because we didn't have enough to store it. There was no concept of fat stored in your abdomen or liver because there was not enough food.
Yeah.
So the body is tuned to it. Insulin levels were kept lower all the time.
Mm.
Now, suddenly in 100 years, the transformation happened so acute that there is surplus of food.
Yeah.
And that thrifty gene is the one which is probably coding for it. Wow. That's one thing I tell a lot of people. Second is I give an example of a country called Nauru. Nauru is Pacific Island, one of the countries off the coast of Australia. Very natural life till I think mid 1850, fishermen, community, hunters, farming. Mm-hmm. That's all they did. Nothing else. No diseases except accidents or age related. Then somebody discovered phosphate, and which part of your fertilizer industry, and then got in, of course, invaded by the Western world.
Yeah.
They gave royalty to the people. That and now we had per capita one of the richest country they became because they got so much money as royalty. I said, forget what, why work? The setback, and everything entered into the system. The food habit changed, excise stopped, fishing stopped. It took only 30 years for the 50% of the population became diabetic. 30% kidney diseases. And the life expectancy started dropping dramatically down. So that's what they coined a term that day. I don't know whether I'm liable for that term, but there's a term called as Coca-Colaization of the country. That's the term they used that time. So that is what happened. So imagine one small community in 40 years changed because of one mistake, one error. We are no different.
Yeah.
We are no different. 50 years, 60 years, things have changed. So I'll tell a lot of patients of mine that go back, ask your grandfather or grandmother, and if you're lucky, your great-grandfather, grandmother, what did they eat and how much they ate? And just follow them. Don't come to me asking for what should I eat and what should I eat.
That's true.
Just go. Whatever they ate all their life, even if it's ghee or whatever, use that.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where the answer is.
Yeah. I'm gathering from all of your information and your experience and knowledge, doctor, that obviously diet plays a role. And I think I like what you spoke about moderation and exercise and diet, because even we had a beautiful podcast with Dan Butner, who studied the blue zones.
Mm-hmm,
and his data comes from the longest living people.
Yeah.
None of them are extreme exercise people. None of them are extreme diet people.
Yeah.
Everything. They have a slower life. They have community. Yeah. They have happiness. Yeah. Everything you spoke about. Quality of food, of course, is better in certain areas in the world. But you're so right about this. So we're just putting a burden on the heart when we do things out of balance. Heart, kidney, body, and everything else. Take us through a day in your life now. You know, now that you've slowed down, you know, you've gone through, like, you know, tell us about your sleep, your food, your exercise regime. Yeah. How do you de-stress? How do you de-stress? All of that, yeah.
I wake up at 4:30 in the morning. So does my wife.
Okay.
And she's the one who has taught me a lot of medicine, a lot about insulin, a lot about diet, and a lot about way of life. So 4:30 we get up, 5 o'clock is the coffee time. So 5:30 I walk out of the house. I go to the race course, I go run somewhere 3 days or 4 days a week. Other 2 days she has pushed me into weight training. I always hated weight training, but made to understand that what weight training is all about and how is it controlling insulin.
Yeah.
So I try to do a little bit of weight.
So your wife a doctor?
She's a physician.
Physician, okay. Yeah. Nice.
So I do weight training twice a week and I have, so that's morning time. Back home, 7:30, get into 7:45, 8 o'clock, leave home, work. My OPD, outpatients, usually cases I keep in theater till 1 o'clock, 11 o'clock. Outpatient till 2 o'clock. Morning breakfast is nothing. I eat 4 boiled eggs, 1 yellow a day, coconut water in the morning. And if I find some cream of coconut, I take it. If it's not there, I move on. And after is just smoothie, which she... It's her portion. I don't know. I never ask what's all inside it, but it seems to be very tasty and healthy these days. So that's my lunch. I try to be back home by 4 o'clock. Then read. try and do a little bit of yoga for 30, 35 minutes or 40 minutes. That's just basically stretching of what the whole thing has gone.
Yeah.
And no TV most of the days, except maybe we can read something, talk. 9, 9:30, I go to sleep.
Beautiful.
And I'm a laughing stock in the hospital. My friends all laugh. Like, how can somebody sleep at 9:30? And I said, what do you do after 9 o'clock? Either you watch TV. Most of the people end up watching Netflix, shows, and I am so filled up, so out of place because I don't watch anything. But that's all right. At least I use that time to sleep. Children are abroad, both of them, are studying. So I went through that emptiness thing, which, but we are filled up with a lot of it. So that's usual. I use weekends. If I'm here, then I play with the canvas because that's my, it's an important thing for me now. I talk to myself.
Nice.
So it's the canvas talking to me rather than I talk to canvas. we have a farm where we try and grow a lot of vegetables.
Nice.
So once in 3 weeks, we go there and try to, no more dirty on hand. We used to do that once upon a time, but now we just go and sit and do nothing.
Mm-hmm.
And this art of do nothing is amazing.
Yeah.
So that's in a nutshell.
Beautiful.
What we do. That's all it's about. I try to work Friday, weekends. Saturday I've stopped working of late.
Okay.
Because it would spill over and it will be no time for it to do anything else in life. And then you realize that there's so much to do because there's something fascinating about time.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's amazing. I like the simplicity in your lifestyle. And what about the sports cardiology center that you're looking at putting together? How's that going for you?
That's a dream which I'm trying to work on it. First, because there's a lacune. And second, because I've been getting a lot of runners who come to me or those who exercise who come to me. And I see that their eagerness to go back sports after cardiology. And I see a lot of patients who are younger who undergoing procedures and how it changes that about 3 months back, I went for my round in the morning and this one patient on bed number one, and I still remember, and he had just been extubated post bypass surgery day one. And he was, day one is serious. It's a lot of pain, He just opened my eyes and he saw me and he said, are you Dr. Sudhir Pillai? I said, yes. I said, I under bypass surgery because of you. But I said, I have not seen you before. He said, no, I read about you. And I realized that bypass surgery is not the end. It's the beginning. These are his words. And I would like to, I'm using your example so that I get better in life. And that is why I'm going through this. And that's the time I realized that how much people are keen to go back to normal life.
Yeah.
But how to guide them? You have to have a structured program. No athlete should die. Nobody should die. Correct that. But to running event, youngster who we lost during last half marathon here also, it's all preventable. Lot is preventable. Lot is preventable among youngsters. If I tell you the chances of mortality or death of sudden cardiac death is about 1 in 20,000 among basketball players. It's high. It's preventable. You can work on it. So that is one goal. And second is, of course, to get them back into the society.
Yeah.
You can't let them in one corner of society. I said, you had a cardiac surgery, now sit tight. Which is the normal advice most people get.
Yeah.
Now control yourself, do nothing, sit there, walk, meditate. So we wanted to do something here. And I explored in India, nothing, Asia, nothing. There's no program. So I went to US about 3 months back. I was amazed the kind of work they are doing in sports cardiology. There are institutes of sports cardiology developing there who are guiding people. NFL, they are big leagues. They're all getting checked. The people who are, they're playing golf. I saw one guy with one hand, one leg, and he said, I still want to play. And there's so much keenness to do that.
Yeah.
And why should? Because that's the attitude we need. Never to, why give up? I mean, physically, you cannot give up. There's so much to do. Why should you control?
And once you give up in the mind, the body follows, right? It just responds to everything.
It's natural.
Yeah.
And we have a population which is aging. We want people to be active. It's important. So that's why the whole thing. Then I'm trying. It's first of all, people don't understand what it's all about. They think it's a rehabilitation, that cardiac surgery and the rehabilitation. I said, no, it's not rehabilitation. It's more than that. It's to equate yourself normally as other people. And I said, who's better qualified than me to do this?
Yeah.
It's me who probably went through the same trough. And at least I can give my wisdom. I have to leave some information down there because I may or may not exist tomorrow, but the information should be there that some generation will benefit. And at least I can create some awareness. There was no monetary here. And when I presented a data to our hospital, Hinduja, I said, you have to invest and you will not make 1% profit on it. There is no return of equity. There is no return of investment. It's an added value. And don't expect me to generate revenue. If you're happy to do that, then only do it. Otherwise, I'll walk off and I'll do it on my own. So that's all. So I don't know hospitals will do it or not because there is not much money to be made in it.
But good luck with that dream, doctor. Good luck. I hope it works out for you. Doctor, if you had the whole world listening to you right now, what message would you leave them with your years of experience, cardiologists, the amazing work you've been doing? What message would you give to everyone watching you right now?
Message is, youngsters, the message would be your first 20 years of your life, 25 years of life is going to decide your next 70. So if you correct yourself here or if you remain in a healthy range, you will benefit a lot in later on in your life. And second thing, for my specific message would be something patients or people who have had cardiac issues is accept it. Accept it not as an end to anything, accept it as a beginning of something, add value to it. And I have a note in my clinic, I used to put it that there is something very fascinating on life, about life, when you live on a borrowed terms. Everyone live on a borrowed terms, but most people don't understand it. But when you go through a procedure or surgery, you understand the limitation that everything is finite. And that's the time you look at life and you say, there's something there. You need that something else, some procedure or something to understand that. So events happen in life. We have to learn from it. That's all I would say. Nothing else.
That's beautiful, doctor. I have to throw in one more question. Have you seen miracles happen in your life through your practice? Just, you know, has your journey made you more spiritual, seeing, you know, life, death, so many things happen? Just an open question.
No, I will not say miracle happen.
Like beyond science, have you seen like things that are unexplained energies that suddenly bring a healing to a person where you have, like you spoke about, a 20% that we never know about? Do you see these things happen? I just want your take as a cardiologist with so much of experience.
No, there are two things. One is sometimes we do everything. Every possible thing for, and still things don't work out.
Yeah.
That's the time you understand your own, how your modesty and your incompleteness and limitation to what you and science can do. And there's something beyond it. And there are sometimes we give up that things may not work out. Sometimes we write it off. This patient may not make it for 12 hours, 24 hours. They still make it. So that's the time you realize that there is something beyond. Your also understanding of sciences. So as we, most doctors, most cardiologists are, because we see maximum number of deaths happening, we see maximum mortality happening, we understand that there's only a limited thing we can do. Don't try to imitate God, because there is a threshold to which you can heal. Beyond that is the journey you don't understand it.
Doctor, thank you so much. This has been amazing. Thank you for being so humble and generous with your wisdom and your knowledge. And I've enjoyed every bit of it. I'm sure everyone does.
Thanks.
But thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you so much, doctor.
Thank you.
Stay tuned for more. We're going to continue our journey, learning, sharing, and evolving.